These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
Thank you.
I make music with my friends.
He's got a laptop. There it is. He's got a laptop.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
You're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com and People for People Radio Network and whichever other affiliated network you may be tuning in on. Welcome, everybody. Hopefully, by the time that today into this show, if you stick with me, I hope to prove to you that those folks that are always saying that there's no such thing as free energy just simply did not pay attention in science class. And so today, how energy travels. I'm going to play a couple podcasts just to give you a general idea. If you pay really close attention to what all these folks are saying, and you'll get a general basic idea of what's actually going on. If you study electricity and you study water and you study air pressure and all the different known physics, the things that happens in nature, there's something, there's a common denominator to it all. And so with that said, the energy that surrounds us, the magnetic field or whatever you want to call it, you know, the Earth has a strong magnetic field, you know, they say there's, you know, this reason why you can find north and south on a compass and such. Well, there's a whole lot more going on than meets the eye, but, you know, till we can get down in there to the really super fine with the super microscope to see on subatomic level what's actually occurring, we have to go with the basic understandings of what we know in physics and science and, you know, our observation to this point. So with that said, I'm going to start off and let you hear this one lady talking about, you know, how energy travels.
Here we have an ordinary piece of rope. It's not one of those magician's ropes that can mysteriously be put back together once it's been cut in half. And it's not particularly strong or durable, but you might say that it does have special powers because it's going to demonstrate for us the physics of travelling waves. Ropes and strings are really good for this kind of thing because when you move them back and forth, the movement of your hand travels through the rope as a wave. By observing what happens to this rope when we try different things with it, we'll be able to see how waves behave, including how those waves sometimes disappear completely. How's that for a magic trick? This is a typical wave, and waves form whenever there's a disturbance of some kind. Often when something about the physical world changes, the information about that disturbance gradually moves outwards, away from the source in every direction. And as the information travels, it makes a wave shape. Think about the disturbance you cause, for example, when you jump on a trampoline. When you hit the trampoline, the downward push that you create moves the material next to it down a little bit too. And the same goes for the material next to that, and so on. And while that information is traveling outward, the spot where your feet first hit the trampoline is already recovering, moving upward again because of the tension force in the trampoline, and that moves the area next to it upward too. This up and down motion gradually ripples outwards, covering more and more of the trampoline, and the ripples take the shape of a wave. Waves are made up of peaks with crests, the bumps on the top, and troughs, the bumps on the bottom. They have an amplitude, which is the distance from the peaks to the middle of the wave. They also have a wavelength, which is the distance between crests, a full cycle of the wave, and a frequency, which is how many of those cycles pass through a given point every second. Multiply the wavelength by the frequency and you get the wave speed, how fast it's going. And the wave speed only depends on the medium it's travelling through. That's why the speed of sound, which is a wave, doesn't depend on the sound itself. It doesn't matter how loud or quiet it is, it just depends on whether the sound is travelling through, say, air or water. Now, there are four main kinds of waves, and we can use our rope to show the difference between some of them. A pulse wave is what happens when you move the end of the rope back and forth just one time. One lonely crest travels through the rope. That's the pulse. Then there's the continuous wave, which is what happens when you keep moving the rope back and forth. In that case, your hand is acting as an oscillator. Anything that causes an oscillation or vibration can create a continuous wave. Now, things that cause simple harmonic oscillation move in such a way that they create sinusoidal waves, meaning that if you plotted the waves on a graph, they'd look a lot like the graph of sine x. But the waves we've mainly been talking about so far are transverse waves, ones in which the oscillation is perpendicular to the direction that the wave is travelling in. When a wave travels along this rope, for example, the peaks are perpendicular to the rope's length. The same thing was mostly true for the waves that you made on the trampoline. The waves were travelling along its surface horizontally, but the peaks were vertical. But there's also longitudinal waves, where the oscillations happen in the same direction as the wave is moving. In the case of a longitudinal wave, the back and forth motion is more of a compression and expansion. These are the kinds of waves that you get by compressing and stretching a spring. And they're also the kinds by which sound travels, which we'll talk about more next time. But all waves, no matter what kind they are, have something in common. They transport energy as they travel. At a microscopic level, waves occur when the movement of one particle affects the particle next to it. And to make that next particle start moving, there has to be an energy transfer. But how can you tell how much energy a wave has? Well, remember that an object in simple harmonic motion has a total energy of 1/2 times the spring constant times the amplitude of the motion squared, which means for a wave caused by simple harmonic motion, every particle in the wave will also have the same total energy of 1/2 kA squared. All of this together tells us that a wave's energy is proportional to its amplitude squared. In other words, if you double the wave's amplitude, you get 4 times the energy, triple the amplitude, and you get 9 times the energy. So why is the relationship between amplitude and energy transport so important? Well, the intensity of a wave is related to the energy it transports. More specifically, its intensity is equal to its power divided by the area it's spread over. And power is energy over time. So changing the amplitude of a wave can change its energy, and therefore its intensity, by the square of the change in amplitude. And this relationship is extremely important for things like figuring out how much damage can be caused by the shock waves from an earthquake. But waves also get weaker as they spread out, because they're distributed over more area. A spherical wave, for example, one that ripples outwards in all directions, will be spread over the surface area of a sphere that gets bigger and bigger the further the wave travels. The surface area of a sphere is equal to 4 times pi times its radius squared. So as a spherical wave moves further from its source, its intensity will decrease by the square of the distance from it. 2 meters away from the source, and the intensity of the wave will be 4 times less than if you are 1 meter away. 3 meters away, and it will be 9 times less. That's why being just a little bit further away from the source of an earthquake can sometimes make a huge difference. Now let's go back to the waves we were making with the rope. Suppose you attach one end of the rope to a ring that's free to move up and down on a rod. Then, with your hand, you send a pulse in the form of a crest, rippling along it. When the pulse gets to the end of the rope slides along the rod, but then it slides back to where it was. That motion, the sliding back, reflects the wave back along the rope, again as a crest. But something totally different happens if you attach the end of the rope so it's fixed and can't move. Now, if you send a pulse along the rope, it will still be reflected, but this time as a trough. The wave was inverted. That's because when the pulse reached the fixed end of the rope, it was trying to slide the end of the rope upward. But it couldn't because the end of the rope was fixed. So instead, the rope got yanked downwards, and the momentum from that downward movement carried the rope below the fixed end, inverting the wave. Now, sometimes multiple waves can combine. For example, say you send 2 identical pulses, both crests, along a rope, one from each end. When the 2 pulses overlap, they combine to make 1 crest. With a higher amplitude than the original ones. That's called constructive interference. The waves build on each other. Now let's say you do the same thing again. This time both waves have the same amplitude, but one's a crest and the other is a trough. And when they overlap, the rope will be flat. It looks like the waves just disappeared. That's called destructive interference, when the waves cancel each other out. Constructive and destructive interference happen with all kinds of waves, pulse or continuous, transverse or longitudinal, and sometimes we can use the effects to our advantage. Noise-cancelling headphones, for example, work by analysing the noise around you and generating a sound wave that destructively interferes with the sound waves from that noise, cancelling it out. There's a lot more to talk about when it comes to the physics of sound, but we'll save that for next time. Today you learned about travelling waves and how their frequency, wavelength and speed are all connected. We also talked about different types of waves, including pulse, continuous, transverse and longitudinal waves, and how they all transport energy. Finally, we discussed reflection and interference. Crash Course Physics is produced in association with PBS Digital Studios. You can head over to their channel and check out a playlist of the latest episodes from shows like Physics Girl, Shanks FX, and PBS Spacetime. This episode of Crash Course was filmed in the Dr. Cheryl C. Kinney Crash Course Studio with the help of these amazing people, and our equally amazing graphics team is Thought Cafe.
Alrighty, so she basically explained with just a piece of string there and some graphics on how waves actually travel and such. If you think about how our environment is around us, we're in a basically a big old energetic suit going on. There's all kinds of things happening that you can't really see. Your eyes just aren't fast enough. And to the extent where your ears can hear it, or you could even smell something, certain things have to be either amplified or occurring at any given time in order for you to be able to sense or detect this this motion going on. Right now every single thing around you, because of the way that it's made up, is molecules, what the science says, proton, neutron and electron. There's like energy going all over the place. I mean, it's moving everywhere. Little particles flying through your room right now, whether they be dust particles or radio waves or any type of wireless transmission from Wi-Fi, and even the to the extent of a transformer that you got, battery charger for your phone or whatever. The strength of that wave right there, is basically propagating out into the atmosphere. And, depending on how powerful that wave is and what type of medium it's going through will determine how, far that it can actually travel. For example, the only reason why we use transformer cores inside of, like the metal laminate or even ferrite cores is because of the difference in the type of the material, for one, but mostly for basically the equivalence of railroad tracks. We're guiding that energy where we want it to go. The magnetic flux is generated via induction whenever you push some current through a coil of wire. The strength of that the strongest portion of that magnetic field is compressed in the center of that coil. And so you want to get as much of that energy to be able to transfer from, if you're going to, like, say, you got 120 volts and you want to either ramp that voltage up or you want to lower it down so that you can run a device that doesn't require so much energy. So you're going to transform that energy wave into either a slower or a weaker wave or a faster and a higher wave, so that you can get high voltage or as opposed to low voltage, or high current as opposed to low current, so on down the line. So we're just using that interruption that's going on whenever putting electrical power to it at whatever given frequency, which means basically, to put it in simple terms, the timing. You know, it's like tapping on the table whenever you 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. That's the frequency. How fast that this is actually going? How many times per cycle that this is actually going? So it's really simple. We're not doing anything spectacular, and you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that, that's what's going on. And so anyway, that strength of that field would determine on how much energy I actually put in there, but that energy is actually transferred on that wave. And so the harder I hit this table, the harder that vibration's going to go down through all those molecules and then come out on the other side. Well, it's the same exact thing that's going on as you're fluctuating the magnetic field in that first coil, which is called the primary on the transformer. And so when you pulse that primary coil really hard, well, it's going to send that energy, through that core over into the other side. You don't actually need the core of the transformer in order to send energy, but you need the core of the transformer in order to maximize how much energy you can get to the secondary coil. You can do wireless energy transfer. If you've got two identical coils and you put a current to one of them and you pulse that current, you can get that second one to act as an antenna and pick that energy up, as long as it's within that field that first coil is actually producing. So you can actually measure the strength of any field and know exactly how far away your wireless energy will actually travel. And the closer you are into that field, the more of that flux actually gets transferred into that second coil. And so even if you wanted to build a step up or step down transmitter, like you got, let's say just hypothetically, you got 100 turns of really thick gauge wire that you're going to be putting a lot of current to, and a medium pulse, maybe 50 or 60 hertz or something like that, like your normal outlet, then you can transfer that energy wirelessly without having that metal in the center. The only purpose for actually having a transformer core to begin with is giving that magnetic flux a path to go to send as much of it as possible over to that second coil. And so that you can transfer that energy and then, you know, basically transform it to whatever frequency you want from that point on. To either ramp up the voltage pressure or lower the voltage down so that you can get high current out the other side. So once you have a basic understanding like that, transformers and electricity is ridiculously simple. It's not hard to understand. It's as simple as, if you got a swimming pool out in your backyard and nothing's going on around there. There ain't no heavy trucks bouncing around or the wind ain't blowing. Everything's calm outside and that you'll have a glassy type, surface on that water. And it's not doing anything. All right, it's just kind of sitting there. It's, down on the microscopic level, there's a lot going on, energetically as far as water just, basically sitting there because everything is vibrating at its own specific resonant frequency. And so, if you go over there and you take your finger and you tap it anywhere in that pool, you'll notice that it sends a wave out. Well, that energy wave that you just produced is transferring that energy from your finger all the way across that pond in all different directions, all the way across that pool in all different directions. And so anything in that wave right there can be affected by it. If you've got, a ball floating in the pond or the pool, and the ball's sitting there, when that wave comes by, it'll raise the ball up and it'll lower the ball back down and so on down the line. But it's definitely affected. The energy was transferred to that ball and actually raised it up higher. And then at some point when it went down to the valley, as this wave is trying to level itself out, it'll actually go down lower down underneath there. So basically like a trampoline. What the lady was explaining. But anyway, once you got that basic understanding about that, then you know that we're only moving things around. We're producing a disturbance, whether it be mechanically or electrically or even audibly, like sound waves and so on, that all this energy is traveling together. It's like if I yell really loud, at your ear, that energy of the amount of energy that I put out is propagating through the atmosphere and then finally hits your eardrum and you're not very happy at me because I just screamed in your ear. Well, the further I am away from you, I can scream really loud, but by the time that wave gets there, it don't sound like I'm screaming very loud. I mean, you can hear me. It's enough power as you can hear me, but it's not enough power to make your ear hurt and make you angry at me as much. So, that's a sample of it. Now, what can we do with that knowledge? See, everybody thinks that, people, they don't believe that energy's free. All right? You can't get something for nothing's basically how they want to lay it out. It's not that energy isn't free. It's just we just don't understand how this actual energy is actually being transmitted, how it's happening. Like right now, as I'm sitting in this room, I'm sending an acoustic wave out to some piezoelectric speakers, and they're basically generating a little current that's being transmitted and then amplified and ramped up over and sent maybe wirelessly some places and basically down hard wires to another place. But the energy that I sent out with my voice is traveling in a wave. It's bouncing off of that speaker and causing that speaker to vibrate. So, like they say, every action is an equal and opposite reaction. Whatever energy I push out is going to do that. But one of the things that Tesla showed everybody was that you could actually amplify that by repeating the same process over and over and over again until you get such a massive wave going on that it's hitting so fast it's building up power. It's building up pressure and such. And so you're able to, with a really fast oscillator, pump an amount of energy into something and then you end up on the other side with really super high voltage power. coming out. Well, that high voltage is still the same energy. There's nothing changed about that energy. You just sped it up. And in reality, you actually did amplify it by that effect being repeated over and over and over again. It's like if I sat there long enough, keep tapping in that pool, I'll start to generate a larger wave of stored energy now. This stored energy, as it's being propagated out through that water in that pool, is building up and building up and building up. And if you got enough space for that energy to go, you can actually store it and basically contain it for, you know, later use down the line, once you understand how it's actually working. This is why I keep talking all the time about high voltage. Why it is that I'm always saying high voltage? What's the point? Well, voltage, because of the way that it actually travels, it's not like trying to push a lot of current. You know, when you push a lot of current through things, and that energy can't flow freely, it meets resistance, and it causes things to get hot. And when they get hot, well, obviously everything has a thermal breakdown, and at some point that thermal breakdown is going to cause whatever device you're trying to use, or, you know, circuitry that you're trying to use, to burn up and then no longer be any good or any use for that matter. So anyway, I'm going to go on to this next one. I got a few of these that I want to play, but if you stick with me, hopefully by the end of this show, you're going to understand that energy really is free. And all we have to do is understand what Tesla was trying to show everybody. He tried to figure out why it is that whenever he pulled this knife switch, that he'd have this sudden surge of power. Was because he had a lot of stored power, a lot of stored pressure behind that switch. Energy looking for a place to go. It was wanting to balance itself out. So as he's generating this power, it keeps coming in and coming in, and it's building up pressure. It ain't got nowhere to go. The moment he turned that switch on, all that energy was able to rush in, and until it stabilized, that's the reason why we got surge protectors nowadays, because you never know if there's a sudden surge of power, and your circuitry can't handle that sudden surge of power, so you got to be able to have it trip the switch so that it doesn't allow that power to go through there, basically breaking the circuit. But that amount of power rushing in is what he figured out, that if you sit there and you oscillate something fast enough, and then you'll keep ramping that power up, and quite literally, you could actually start an earthquake with acoustic waves and such. So any vibration, if you continue to send that energy one right after another, the faster you do that, the higher that potential is going to build up. It's storing energy out there. So let's listen to this real quick.
Transmission of sound. Every sound is produced by a vibration. Vibration is the back and forth movement of an object. As you speak, vibrations are produced by the vocal cords in the throat. You can hear only when the sound energy reaches your ears. But how does sound energy travel? Wonder how that works? Come, let's go across to Dr. Zook. Sound energy travels in the form of sound waves. There are mainly two types of waves, transverse wave and longitudinal wave. Let us see how waves travel. We can use a slinky spring to observe both types of waves. Emily is holding one side of the slinky, while Dr. Zook is holding the other end. With a quick upward flick of the wrist, Dr. Zook has sent energy traveling through the slinky. Notice how the slinky moves? This is a transverse wave. In a transverse wave, the particles vibrate at a right angle to the direction of the wave. The wave traveled from Dr. Zook to Emily and back. Now let's see what a longitudinal wave looks like. Emily is holding one end of the slinky, while Dr. Zook is pulling its other end towards himself, and then pushing it towards Emily. Watch closely, and you will notice that some of the coils crowd close together, and then slowly move farther apart. This is because the vibrations are parallel to the direction of the wave. If the wave moves from right to left, then the particles also vibrate from right to left. This is a longitudinal wave. Sound waves are longitudinal waves.
I'm going to pause that just for a second, because basically when you're talking about the different ways that these waves, horizontal or vertical, how these waves actually are traveling, you can focus energy in any direction you want. And so with that said, the way that when you're talking, if I'm aiming my mouth towards the microphone, obviously I'm going to have a louder sound. But if I take my mouth away from the microphone towards a different direction, it's going to be a weaker sound. So that energy is focused in the opposite direction of where that microphone's actually sitting. So wireless energy, and basically like what you'd see when a satellite dish, you aim the satellite dish towards the satellite, supposedly, and you get these directional beams that come in there, and that's how that energy's transferred from one tower over to your satellite dish, and then it's basically translated by your circuitry, and you get to see your picture on TV and hear the sound and all that kind of stuff. But I just want to throw that in there while they were talking about longitudinal waves and stuff like that, because it also lets you know that you can guide energy in whichever direction you want it to go, and even to the extent of the magnetic flux from a transformer that would normally be lost. If that transformer core was large enough, you wouldn't lose any of that energy. You could make the super efficient transformers that whatever the maximum amount of that magnetic field strength, you would be able to capture every single bit of that energy and move it over to wherever you wanted it to go. So let's continue here.
These waves travel at different speeds in different mediums. The medium could be a solid, liquid, or gas. Now let's see how this works. In a solid, the particles are very close together. Sound energy moves as one particle hits the other particle. With the particles being so close together, sound travels quickest through a solid. If we look at particles in a liquid, they appear to be slightly further apart when compared to solid. Thus, sound energy takes a little longer to travel through a liquid. Look at the particles of gas. They are spread out, and hence, sound waves travel most slowly through them. Now we know how sound travels in different media. The vibration of particles produces waves. Wavelength is the distance between two consecutive compressions or rarefactions. The number of waves passing through a point in a second is called frequency, and it is measured in hertz. Sound waves travel in all directions. Sound gets reflected. That is, it bounces back on hitting a solid surface. Bouncing back of sound is called echo. Bouncing back of sound is purposefully used in detecting depth of seabeds. That's amazing, isn't it? Summary. Every sound is produced by a vibration. Vibrations are produced by our vocal cords when we speak. There are two types of waves, transverse wave and longitudinal wave. In a transverse wave, The particles vibrate at a right angle to the direction of the wave. In a longitudinal wave, vibrations are parallel to the direction of the wave. Sound waves are longitudinal waves. Sound travels quickest through a solid. Wavelength is the distance between two consecutive compressions or rarefactions. The number of waves passing through a point in a second is called frequency, and it is measured in hertz. Bouncing back of sound is called echo.
So, you know, even with that little demonstration right there, if you want to transmit, let's say, data wirelessly or whatever, you can use audible sound to speakers. You know, you can sit there and you can play in tones in one set of speakers, and then have those speakers aimed towards another speaker, and because of the way that acoustic wave, that sound wave is actually hitting the diaphragm of the next speaker in line, it'll produce energy out the back of that deal, and then you can amplify that and get the a replica of what you sent from the one speaker over to the next speaker. So not only are we able to transmit energy wirelessly, but we're actually able to, because of the frequency and how we're actually doing this, we can actually send data along these waves. And the data basically is in the form of waves. You're sending them out either faster at a higher peak or a lower peak or so on down the line. And these fluctuations in the field on the other side, we build equipment that can basically translate what you just sent. It's like your eyes seeing smoke signals on the next hill. You know what those signals mean. And so you can see those through the through the light and in the atmosphere or whatever. So in the first two so far, they're simple explanations of how energy travels and what a wave is and so on down the line. But once again, they all have a common denominator. It's that disruption that we're putting into any system in order to get something done. And so there are a lot of researchers out there that talked about, you know, like the swing set. When you got a boy on a swing set and you're pushing him, and then after a point it gets to where you don't even have to put hardly any energy to the system in order to get that kid swinging way up there. And if you get too much energy going, you'll basically wrap him around the swing set. And so that's probably not a good idea. But nonetheless, it's just a demonstration of how you can take that energy and you can amplify it, you know, by a constant repetitive signal that you're pushing out, even to the extent of when you're tapping on that water in that pool. If you keep doing that long enough in the same frequency range, you'll keep making waves, and those waves will start to slam into each other, and eventually that water will be slopping over the side of the pool because you've continued that disruption long enough. And so even if it's only a small wave that you're producing, the energy that can be gathered out of that is actually stored energy that, once you got that energy stored and then you release all that energy in one go, you're talking about a lot of power. Now these different types of transformers out there, basically just to change energy from one to the next, either lowering the current or raising the voltage on there. But the same amount of power, the same type of energy that it took to get that, is all being transmitted and dispersed equally across whichever surface that you're sending it, or whichever medium you're sending it through, water even, and so on down the line. Like they were saying, basically, that sound on a solid object travels faster because all the particles are, you know, really close together, so they don't have to travel far in order to bump into the next one to affect it. So when you're talking about transmitting through the air, there's a lot of particles in the air, but there's a lot more space as well in between those particles. And so it takes a lot more power to transmit that energy. So let's move right along here. Where are we at?
Hi, I'm Jared. Welcome to Fun Science Demos. Today we want to take a look at two forms of energy, sound and light. And we want to see how those forms of energy move. Both sound energy and light energy travel in waves, and sound waves are a lot slower than light waves. Light waves travel really, really fast. That's why when we see the light from a lightning bolt, it's always before we hear the sound waves of the thunder. So we can use this slinky to show you how sound waves and light waves travel. I'm going to put some energy into this slinky, and I want you to watch how that energy bounces back and forth down the slinky. Watch how it moves. If you look carefully, you can watch the energy move in waves down the slinky and bounce back and forth. That slinky was cool, but we wanted to make a different wave machine to show you how energy travels in waves. To do that, we use duct tape, plain wooden sticks, and lots of candy. Now we're going to take this outside, stretch the wave machine out, and put some energy into the wave machine so you can see how it works. So now we get to see this wave machine in action. A wave is energy, so I need to add some energy to this wave machine, and when I do that, I want you to watch that energy move down the machine from one end back to the other. Watch. Did you see the energy move down the machine, and then back down the machine, and back toward me?
One of the amazing things that if you pay attention to what just occurred, I know you can't see it if you're listening in on the radio, but I did post all these video links on there if you want to go watch actual videos in the Super Chat room over at ShazizRadio.com. But one of the things to note is he only hit that one time. And that one time was enough for that energy to travel all the way down to the end of his wave machine and all the way back and then all the way back out, again until that thing finally came to a balance. So that one tap was enough to send that energy out multiple times until that energy could finally come to rest.
Energy, and they travel in waves a lot like this. Sound energy and light energy are traveling in waves. Let's see what happens when we add more energy to our wave machine. We get a nice, clean, crisp wave that travels down the machine and back and down and back and down and back. The candy wave machine. It was so cool to see how that wave energy traveled down that wave machine. But if you wanted to explore waves on your own, there's a great simulation put out by the people from FET. And we're going to zoom in and explore it a little bit to see what that does. The simulation is called Wave on a String. So let's take a look and see what it can do. Explore it. Well, I see a wave machine that looks a lot like our wave machine. It's stretched out. And just like we put some energy in our wave machine to see that wave travel, let's put some energy into this wave machine. And there the wave is. You can see it travel down from one end and back to the other. Let's do it one more time. Well, what happens if I make that energy bigger? If I introduce more energy, I can turn up a little dial here and make my wave bigger. I can turn it up all the way, put more energy into it, and you can see my wave gets bigger. The other thing we can do, if we wanted these waves to come automatically, is we can hit this button up here, and the machine makes the waves come automatically. We can also hit this button up here, if we wanted to collect some data and really measure things, rulers come onto the screen. There's so much that this simulation can do, you can explore it on your own. Sound and light energy travel in waves. You can try making your own wave machine, or check out some cool simulations on waves. If you want to learn even more about sound energy and light energy and how they travel, check out our links in the video description. Science is so cool. Thanks for watching.
So, with those demonstrations, those wave machines, the reason why I'm trying to explain these to you so that you can get a visual of how and what's actually occurring in the what we call electricity. So some people think that the electron theory may very well be the way that everything is. I'm thinking there might just very well be something more to it than just electrons trading places and stuff like that. If all these little mini micro universes, which we call atoms, protons, neutrons, and electrons, are flowing around each other, and they have a little tiny magnetic field of their own, and every time these magnetic fields come in contact with each other, they couple and they become one. And so that's one of the reasons why we can actually transmit energy from one coil to the next, either wirelessly, through the atmosphere, or which would be called a coreless transformer or air transformer. And also we can also travel and send that energy to get more of that wave out to the other side. We can actually use transformer cores. Now, instead of using we're using laminated metal sheets to make a laminated core, and the reason why we do that is because if you put a solid iron core in there, those particles that make up that iron are so close together that they're banging into each other rapidly, and so you actually generate little currents inside. They're called eddy currents that cause this thing to get really super hot, basically destroy the transformer. And so in order to get around that, we separated the metal in layers and put a coating of non-conductive material so the electricity can't travel freely through from each one of these sheets to the next, which now gives us the capability of actually still guiding that power where we want it to go into the secondary, but it doesn't cause it to get hot. And for higher frequency waves, for like audio sound, where we don't want to have any distortion or anything, we actually use a ferrite type of material, that those particles are not as close together. They're all basically separated in whatever type of resins or whatever they put these things together in. And so you still get the magnetic flux can actually guide around through there, and actually a magnet will stick to it, but it helps to keep it cooler, because you're sending a higher frequency wave in there. And if you tried to do that with, like say, a regular iron laminated, that iron laminated, because of that really high frequency, would be able to get really hot really quick. So anyway, let's move right along here.
Something surrounds you, bombards you, some of which you can't see, touch, or even feel. Every day, everywhere you go, it is odorless and tasteless, yet you use it and depend on it every hour of every day. Without it, the world you know could not exist. What is it? Electromagnetic radiation. These waves spread across a spectrum from very short gamma rays to X-rays, ultraviolet rays, visible light waves, even longer infrared waves, microwaves, to radio waves which can measure longer than a mountain range. This spectrum is the foundation of the information age and of our modern world. Your radio, remote control, text message, television, microwave oven, even a doctor's X-ray, all depend on waves within the electromagnetic spectrum. Electromagnetic waves, or EM waves, are similar to ocean waves in that both are energy waves. They transmit energy. EM waves are produced by the vibration of charged particles and have electrical and magnetic properties. But unlike ocean waves that require water, EM waves travel through the vacuum of space at the constant speed of light. EM waves have crests and troughs like ocean waves. The distance between crests is the wavelength. While some EM wavelengths are very long and are measured in meters, many are tiny and are measured in billionths of a meter, nanometers. The number of these crests that pass a given point within 1 second is described as the frequency of the wave. One wave, or cycle, per second is called a hertz. Long EM waves, such as radio waves, have the lowest frequency and carry less energy. Adding energy increases the frequency of the wave and makes the wavelength shorter. Gamma rays are the shortest, highest energy waves in the spectrum. So, as you sit watching TV, not only are there visible light waves from the TV striking your eyes, but also radio waves transmitting from a nearby station, and microwaves carrying cell phone calls and text messages, and waves from your neighbor's Wi-Fi, and GPS units in the cars driving by. There is a chaos of waves from all across the spectrum passing through your room right now. With all these waves around you, how can you possibly watch your TV show? Similar to tuning a radio to a specific radio station, our eyes are tuned to a specific region of the EM spectrum and can detect energy with wavelengths from 400 to 700 nanometers, the visible light region of the spectrum. Objects appear to have color because EM waves interact with their molecules. Some wavelengths in the visible spectrum are reflected and other wavelengths are absorbed. This leaf looks green because EM waves interact with the chlorophyll molecules. Waves between 492 and 577 nanometers in length are reflected, and our eye interprets this as the leaf being green. Our eyes see the leaf as green, but cannot tell us anything about how the leaf reflects ultraviolet, microwave, or infrared waves. To learn more about the world around us, scientists and engineers have devised ways to enable us to see beyond that sliver of the EM spectrum called visible light. Data from multiple wavelengths help scientists study all kinds of amazing phenomena on Earth, from seasonal change to specific habitats. Everything around us emits, reflects, and absorbs EM radiation differently based on its composition. A graph showing these interactions across a region of the EM spectrum is called a spectral signature. Characteristic patterns, like fingerprints within the spectra, allow astronomers to identify an object's chemical composition and to determine such physical properties as temperature and density. NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope observed the presence of water and organic molecules in a galaxy 3.2 billion light-years away. Viewing our Sun in multiple wavelengths with the SOHO satellite allows scientists to study and understand sunspots that are associated with solar flares and eruptions harmful to satellites, astronauts, and communications here on Earth. We are constantly learning more about our world and universe by taking advantage of the unique information contained in the different waves across the EM spectrum.
So, how's that gonna get you off of paying an electric bill? Well, once you understand how this energy is actually traveling, and the fact that right now we're sitting here being bombarded by tons and tons of magnetic waves and sound waves and radio waves of all different ranges. I did a video quite some time back, actually a video series called Free Thinkers, and I was hoping that more people would understand what it is I was trying to point out. But that particular series, it took a bit of everything. Not necessarily everything there is, but it took a whole lot of different energies that come in from different directions and focused it into a storage bank. And so to this very day, that thing's still working. It's over time rusted and corrosion and all that kind of stuff, but for some reason, it's still functioning the way it did when it was designed. And the purpose of that thing was to pick up every type of energy you could possibly think about, in guide it right down into, you know, different types of capacitors and such. And so it was picking up radio waves, it was picking up negative ions, it was picking up static electricity, it was picking up wind power, solar power, thermoelectrics, even a galvanic, basically chemistry style, types of way to move energy around, because, you mix two different chemicals together, they have a reaction with each other, where everything inside that chemical and the other chemical are either jiving with each other or not, there's something going on. Now, nature's trying to stabilize whatever you just did. It's trying to balance it back out. And so until everything's back into its balance and there's a path for that energy to travel, then you'll have a reaction going on. Once everything stabilizes and you don't have the reaction happening anymore, everything will be leveled right back out again. That's how nature functions. If you stand by the lake shore or the seashore or even by the riverside, you can see examples of everything you've heard so far in all these videos of pressure and different types of waves, and even to the extent of how that you can get a visual in your mind of how that energy is actually traveling. You got a lot of water going down a river. That's a whole lot of forward motion, a whole lot of current, and you can tap into that on the way down. You can make a hydroelectric dam and catch some of that pressure and turn it into electricity by spinning, some sort of rotor with magnets on it past coils or vice versa. And so, that's how we basically view electricity. But something else may be going on down inside there on a smaller level than we can actually see. We could actually be right now sitting in a sea of what we call electricity. Like two magnetic fields slamming into each other, producing, another type of wave that actually sends out a vibration that basically we can actually feel in the form of electricity. And at a certain extent, it might even actually be lethal, depending on how much power is involved going on. So those are just some thoughts on the deal. But nonetheless, once you get a general idea of how this energy is actually traveling, then we can build super efficient transformers and electric motors in order to be able to maximize that power usage. And essentially, we're only tapping into what nature's already provided. And then when you see those visuals of what's going on, like, for example, that river that I spoke about, the moment you put a dam in front of that, well, that energy has nowhere to go. It's going to continue to keep on coming towards that dam. If you do nothing, then the pressure is going to continue to build up, and then it'll either go over the top of the dam and wash away all the material around the side of the dam until eventually the dam will break and the energy will rush out and then finally balance itself back out to its normal stream again. When you're plugging something into the wall outlet and that energy, it continues to come in. It doesn't stop. There's no point at which the appliance that you're running tells the energy from the wall, hey, look, I'm getting too much. And what it should have been doing all along is storing that energy and only using the amount necessary to run the fan. But because you got a constant current coming to that fan, and that energy's backing up, it's the equivalence of what's going on in that dam. That energy has to have a place to go. If it hasn't got no place to go, it starts to generate little currents. Just like in that transformer that we talked about earlier, it's generating little currents. And those little currents in that metal, because of how close the particles are together in that metal, will cause it to even get hotter, even more energetic. But if you got a space for that energy to go, then that transformer will never get hot. And so, by understanding technologies such as like capacitors, a capacitor is a storage. It's like a glass. You know, you can put so much water in a glass, and then eventually it's going to run over the top. Once you get that stored pressure in there, I did a video called Physics Toy. And basically, it's a balloon inside of a plastic bottle, and there's a hole in one side of it, and you can actually put your finger over that hole, and in the process of trying to put energy into it, you'll meet resistance because the pressure equalizes on the opposite side because it meets resistance. Once you take your finger off that hole, you can blow the balloon up inside there. And then when you get the balloon blown up inside there, you can put your finger back on the hole, leave the lid wide open, and you can hold that energy inside that balloon. Now granted, a little tiny bit of it's going to actually escape. But the stored pressure isn't necessarily in the atmosphere. It's in that rubber balloon. That rubber balloon has been stretched out now. And it can't go back the other direction because you just created a tiny vacuum in between that balloon and the plastic bottle by putting your finger over that. You aren't allowing any atmosphere to get inside there so that balloon can go back the other direction. But the moment that you take your finger off that hole, not only will you hear a little hissing noise as that vacuum releases and allows air to enter that bottle, but now it will allow that balloon to go back to its natural state. And so in the process of that, whatever atmosphere is inside that balloon will be pushed forward out there. Now, if I took and I blew up the balloon and I had my finger over the hole and then I closed the lid on the bottle, snap the lid shut, now I produced a seal and I can take my finger off of that and the balloon will not go back the other direction because it still has a blockage in way. The cap is now holding that atmospheric pressure inside there. Well, the same thing does with the capacitor. You have to allow a path for that energy to be able to travel in order for it to balance itself back out. So we're able to store electricity in a can, so to speak. Just like air pressures, if you go watch my video Physics Toy and you see the one with the bottle in there, you'll understand exactly what I'm talking about. Until I open that lid, I can store that energy in there. The moment I open that lid, well, then all that energy is suddenly released and everything balances itself back out. So, with that said, that gives you a visual and a mental understanding of how this energy is functioning. And we're able to now, with technology we have available to us, we're able to use transistors and MOSFETs and different types of like 555 timers, little chip, microchips that are able to turn power on and off by whenever you got enough voltage going through something, it'll actually open a gate and allow things to occur. So we got some really cool technology that allows us to manipulate power on demand how we want it. And then if we have an understanding of how that energy is actually functioning, inducing the current or so on down the line, and how we are actually guiding that power wherever we want it to go. The copper wire isn't nothing more than railroad tracks, you know. You're guiding that electricity where you want it. And because of the different the ways that we wind these coils up, the center of that coil wire is where all the strength of that magnetic field basically gathers. It's compressing that magnetic field in the center of that coil. It can't get out of there. And that's why that neodymium magnet accelerator, if you check out that video that I did, you can see that visual effect, because that magnet is stuck inside that field and it hasn't got anywhere to go. And so it's trying to get out. And so it ends up flying around in a circle inside there. And at some point, because it is a magnet and has a north and south on there, the faster that thing gets suspended, it starts to generate its own specific frequency. That own specific frequency can be detected, it can be stored, it can be guided, and if you could actually build, which we can, if you could actually build a system to detect that spin of that magnet and that change in that magnetic field as it's spinning around there, then you'd be able to hear an actual tone. You'd be able to hear what that electricity sounds like. In some of the videos that I've done here recently, I've got a DDS signal generator that you can actually hear an audible sound, because I've connected it to a speaker, and so as that signal's being pulsed, you can hear what 1 hertz sounds like as opposed to 10 hertz or 50 hertz or 60 hertz. You can hear a definite tone in there. It's just speeding up and slowing down, and it's producing a sound wave because of the way that we're using that energy in reverse and pushing that speaker back and forth, that diaphragm on that speaker, which then in turn interacts with the atmosphere around you and sends out a sound wave so that you can hear. So all we've been doing all along is moving power from point A to point B. And if you instead of striving to reach 0 point or over unity and just shoot for super efficiency, you're going to find out that you're going to find free electricity. You're going to find free energy. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. If you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough, because we're surrounded by it. There's no real such thing as a solid object as far as science says. If science is what it says, as far as the electron, the proton, and the neutron, and the way all these atoms work on an atomic level or a microscopic level or whatever, that they're in energetic particles. Even this plastic bottle that I'm holding in my hand has its own vibration, and any interaction that I have with this, you know, with the balloon dangling down in there, I can slap that balloon back and forth, and you can hear. It produces a sound. So it was my interaction with that actually, generated a different type of energy, a different frequency range, that now my ears can even hear. But we can even detect the sound of an object that's sitting still. So, if you take, for example, when you think about a hearing aid. And there's different spy devices out there where you can actually zoom in really to sounds that are really far away, and you can zoom in on conversations. Well, how's that working? They're like too far away for you to be able to hear with your ears, but yet you can hear this with that deal. So there's technology available to quite literally build receivers that can pick up any frequency range. And if you can pick up that frequency range on a receiver, then that means that you can actually store that energy wave as it's coming through in the form of electricity. And so there's nothing really stopping us from actually tapping into even space radiation or vibrations of the Earth. Every time somebody moves, the atmosphere around it is interacted with. And so that atmosphere, my wave my hand in the air, I produced a wave that went across there. Now, depending on how hard I did it and how often I did it would determine how much disruption's going on inside there. But it's not rocket science, folks. It's really simple, basic science. It's simple, basic physics. So, if we take in conjunction every single thing that we're talking about, and we actually focus that energy to where we want it to go, we can pull energy from many different mediums. You know, everything that's going on out there. If I tap on the deal there, I'm sending not only acoustic wave, but a vibration down that doggone deal that I'm tapping on. And so I'm moving energy in all different directions. Anywhere within that range of what that's doing, I can tap into that energy. This is what I've been trying to say for a long time. And then if you want to get super efficiency, you first got to understand how energy travels to begin with. It's traveling in waves, and that energy rides those waves, and you can send a signal on top of a signal and multiple different frequencies in all different directions. So you're talking about whatever from zero all the way up to the terahertz and beyond. You can get energy from every different direction. You just need a receiver to be able to pick it up. And some of them might be weaker than the other. It depends on how far you're actually away from the initial source. But nonetheless, even if it's only, in the milliamp range, it's still storable power. And it doesn't matter. If you got an empty container, it doesn't matter which direction this energy comes from. It all will add into that. And so if I only got 100 volts with no current involved at all, it might take me a little bit longer to charge that capacitor up, but it's going to charge. And once that pressure is constantly pushed in there, and eventually the voltage starts to lower down and the pressure starts to go up, and now I take that DDS signal generator, and I'm pushing off of a 5-volt input. They say that these particular models will produce 9 volts on the output when it's not under load. Well, I'm running it through a microwave oven transformer, pulsing a wave through that transformer core into the secondary, and ramping the voltage up to around about 100 or more volts. And I'm then in turn running down through AC start capacitors, which normally wouldn't be used in an AC circuit because they're not designed to handle a lot of current. But since I'm not using current, I'm just using voltage alone, I'm able to transmit that energy and store it into those capacitors and bring it on down the line and then push it in through a bridge rectifier. Well, that rectifier, normally, if you had a lot of current to it, if I had 100 volts, at couple amps, eventually that rectifier is going to meet that resistance because the energy continues to come in and that rectifier is going to get hot. But because of what the rectifier actually does by changing an AC wave into a DC, then that means that all I need is voltage to do that. I don't need that current to do that. All I need is that voltage. I need that signal, and then that signal will come out the other side in the form of DC. Keep in mind, once again, we're not talking about current. We're talking about voltage. But it just smoothed that signal out, and that signal is 100 volts or more that I can use to store into a DC style capacitor. And then from that point on, it's trickle charged over into what's now referred to as supercapacitors or boost caps. And these, because of the way that they're designed, actually work more like a battery. And so now I'm transforming that energy back into usable power again. It might take me a little bit longer if I only got 100 volts. to charge those batteries up, or charge those capacitors up, which then in turn bleeds over into batteries, charging the batteries up. But if I ramp that voltage up, that's the trick right there. Now, voltage, it doesn't meet resistance like current does. And so if you've got that high voltage, you can charge those capacitors really quickly. It'd be the equivalence of if you take a balloon and you blow it up with your lips and blow that balloon up, and you got to breathe in a little bit of air, push it out, and breathe in a little bit of air, push it out, and into the balloon, you got to force that pressure in there. Well, obviously, it's going to take you a minute to do that. But if instead of using your lungs to blow that air into that balloon, you take an air compressor that has stored energy in it, and you put it on that balloon and turn that power on, depending on the PSI, the pounds per square inch of air pressure that you've got stored, you can blow that balloon up instantaneously and pop it, explode that balloon. Well, the same thing would be with a capacitor, because a capacitor is the equivalence of a balloon. It's an empty container that you're going to store pressure in. So if you can charge these capacitors rapidly, and then charge and discharge, charge and discharge, charge and discharge, when you got these capacitors connected to a battery, and then on the opposite side, when you got a load connected to that battery, that pressure that is stored in the capacitor is basically skating right across the battery, because the battery can't accept that power that fast, and so it will ram into the load, and eventually between the current from the battery and the voltage from the deal, that appliance on the other side is going to start getting hot. It's got too much power coming to it. But if between the battery and the load you actually have another storage bank that is large enough to still allow the amount of energy necessary to run that motor, but allow all the excess to be stored and guided off somewhere else, now that motor will never get hot and it won't bog down on you anymore. When you start to put your generators under load, they will not bog down if that energy has a place to go. When you're trying to push power to a battery from a generator, that battery is trying to push power back. It cannot accept that energy fast enough. And since it can't accept that energy fast enough, its only option is to push back. And so now you're meeting resistance on both sides. You're meeting resistance from your generator, you're meeting resistance in the wire, and you're meeting resistance from the battery itself. And so these two, all these three factors in there are fighting against each other, which are generating little tiny currents, whirlpools, and the disturbance that are causing things to get hot. And the wire obviously is going to get hot quicker because its particles are closest together. So there ain't nowhere for that energy to go. And so it's going to continue to get hot. But if you give that that energy a place, a path to go away from that deal, you can still regulate how much power that motor is actually getting, and only give that motor exactly the amount that it takes to get the mechanical work that it needs to do. You don't have to have near the amount of power it's coming out of your wall outlet to run your fan, your TV, your computers, or anything like that. We're shoving too much power to all of our devices, and that's why they're getting hot. People seem to be under the impression that you have to have all this current in order to get work done, which is simply not the case. You don't need that much power to run these things. And that current is what's actually causing your transistors to fail. It's causing your MOSFETs to fail. It causes your resistors to get really hot. All just to guide the amount of energy needed to run a specific device. You got so much power coming from that wall outlet that you have to use resistance in order to slow that power down. Otherwise, it'll blow up your device. But in the problem that you now have is that your transistors and your resistors and your diodes and all of those smaller deals are going to get hot and they're going to burn up. But if you control the energy between the output, which would be the battery, and the input, which would be your source of whatever device you're running, and that wire, you allow that energy a place to go, you can adjust it to the sweet spot, the exact spot that motor will do exactly at full power what it would have done otherwise without any part of that system ever getting hot. If done properly, you wouldn't even need a breaker switch anymore. The breaker switches are they're a thermoelectric device, is what they are, a thermal device. Basically, when your breaker gets too hot, when there's too much current being drawn through there, it'll get too hot, and it'll trip the switch. Well, when that fails, and that switch isn't tripped, then it's going to go to the next weakest part, which would be your insulation in your wire. Starts smelling, it's going to get hot, and eventually it'll reach its thermal breakdown and fail, catch fire, and short your wiring out. And there you go. But it's, like I said, it's not the fact that we don't have enough power. We got more than enough power that we need to run so much more. The energy that comes in your house ought to be able to run 100 houses or more. You don't need near that much power to run stuff. Anytime two magnetic fields come in contact with each other, they will couple. And those two will interact with each other. Depending on which polarity one or the other is, they will either attract or they will repel each other. I gotta see if I don't remember if we listened to this one here yet, but let's try this.
The inventor Nikola Tesla dreamt of wireless power. Among his work in the realm of electricity, he built a coil, later named the Tesla coil, which could illuminate lamps from across a room and throw the occasional bolt of lightning at the nearest conductor. Tesla coils remain popular today, though often for their ability to put on a fantastic lightning show. Nikola Tesla believed in wireless power with such an enthusiasm that, with the financing of J.P. Morgan, he constructed a giant apparatus, the Wardenclyffe Tower, at his lab in Shoreham, Long Island in 1901. This was before the world was wired.
Way back then, when people were thinking about electricity and how people might use it, I don't think it ever occurred to them that people would string wires all over the country. Early on, people were thinking about transferring power wirelessly.
The idea? To send wireless power around the globe.
We love electricity so much, human beings love it so much, that we've been willing to put in wired power everywhere. I'm sure if you go back to Tesla's time, he wanted to do things wirelessly and experimented with it because he thought, who would be crazy enough to put in the trillions of dollars of infrastructure that we've put in?
More than a century after Tesla's tower, we're still tethered to the wall. Witricity, a startup in Watertown, Massachusetts, is one of several companies hoping to revive Tesla's dream, and it's doing so by developing a business in wireless power transfer.
There's power everywhere in the world except that last few feet from the wall to the center of the room. That is the last part to go wireless.
And once that last part goes wireless, this projector can receive its power from a source that's almost a meter below. Here's how it works. Run an electric current through a coil of copper wire, and the coil will produce a short-range magnetic field. Place a second coil within this field, and an electric current will flow through it. The magnetic field has transferred electrical power from one coil to the other. This principle is called induction, and it has been understood for more than a century. Induction is what charges a wireless electric toothbrush, for example, and it works well over extremely short distances. Pull the coils apart, and the power transfer ceases. It turns out that the trick to longer distance power transfer is the same principle an opera singer uses to shatter a wine glass from across the room. It's called resonance. For the opera singer, when the frequency of the sound wave matches the unique resonant frequency of a glass, the acoustic energy is converted to kinetic energy at the highest possible efficiency. The energy then builds inside the glass until it shatters. The coils that Witricity uses to transfer power wirelessly are magnetic resonators. First, A rapidly oscillating electric current is applied to a coil at its specific resonant frequency. This creates a magnetic field in the region around the coil. Tune a second coil to the same resonant frequency as the source, and it will couple, resonating anywhere within that region and converting the oscillating magnetic field into an electrical current within the second coil. This response is called highly coupled magnetic resonance, and it hasn't been done before. By attaching the second coil to a device, such as the battery of an electric car or a mobile phone, this current can be made to do useful work. The source can be either centimeters or meters away from the device being powered, and can deliver power through walls or around metal obstacles. The power can even be distributed across multiple devices at once. So by a simple trick of physics, power is transferred wirelessly. Nikola Tesla would be proud.
You could put these resonators in walls, in floors, in ceilings, and would allow you to power virtually anything in your house. You could place it under the counters. Imagine you could just go home and you carry your purse, you throw your purse onto the counter, and you don't even have to think about taking your phone or your camera or your PDA out of your purse. It just charges because the surface underneath your counter is energized.
Vitricity is developing a system, not a specific product, and as a result, they have many different platforms on display at once. In Vitricity's demonstration rooms, a flat-screen television is powered using a resonator hidden in its base. Laptops, with their batteries removed and replaced by resonators, flicker on, and flashlights glow when placed next to a source concealed behind a bulletin board. The system can even be extended beyond the range of a single source, using passive resonators like this one. By this method, many cabinet lights are lit well beyond the expected range of the single source below.
Maybe no surprise, you get the light to come on even inside the cabinet, way up in the cabinet.
You can almost think of it as though the energy is held by the structure itself. We're not sending electricity through the air, and it doesn't radiate out into space. It's when another kind of a copper coil or wire coil comes in the vicinity of that field that it can sense it and then capture it and turn that magnetic field into a current. So safety is definitely one of the issues that people think about and ask us about. So one of the things that makes it very safe is the fact that we're using the magnetic field to transfer the power. Humans look almost like free space to a magnetic field. In addition to that, you know, we have a lot of electronic devices that we use every day, and so there are well-established standards for what the fields around those devices can look like, and all the technology that we develop will conform to those same kind of standards.
The intensity of the magnetic fields we're using, by the way, are about the same intensity as that of the Earth. Most people don't think of it, but the Earth we're in a magnetic field right now.
The applications of wireless power in a wired world are endless, and rethinking infrastructure may be decades away. A simple first step could be removing costly batteries from things as mundane as computer accessories, and instead placing a small wireless resonator in the computer itself, tackling waste by centimeters at first.
So at the end of the day, if you can find something that is convenient for people and saves energy, that's the killer app.
Wireless power has in fact been available for decades, just waiting for a clever user to snatch it out of the air. It exists in radio and television signals and is available 24 hours a day. Josh Smith and Alanson Sample of Intel Labs in Seattle, Washington, are pointing their devices at television antennas and powering small but useful gadgets solely off of the energy that carries TV programs.
Well, there's energy all around us. TV signals, which you normally think of as just information, also have a little bit of energy content.
One of their projects is named WARP, and it stands for Wireless Ambient Radio Power. According to them, we are just entering the boom years of energy harvesting.
We're receiving energy from the TV towers that are 4 kilometers out that way. They're putting out a megawatt of power. This TV antenna picks up the radio signal, comes through this coax cable here, little rectifying circuit, turns the radio signal into regular DC voltage, just like a battery would put out. And right now it's powering this kitchen thermometer. So as we turn this away from the TV tower, at a certain point, it's going to lose power. Now it's off because it's not facing the TV tower. If we bring it back, it pops back on as soon as it's got enough energy.
So here's the TV tower, transmitting tower. here, we're up here near the University of Washington. These circles show the amount of power you'd expect to be able to get as a function of distance. So kind of anywhere in the city of Seattle, you'd expect to be able to get up to, you know, 100 microwatts.
Compared to solar, of course, solar is a really good energy harvesting source, but it's only available for 12 hours a day. Your TV is always there.
Yeah, TV towers have been broadcasting about the same amount of energy or power for, you know, decades. But what's changed recently is that the power requirements of the smallest devices have gotten low enough that you can actually power them off a TV tower now.
Josh Smith says wireless ambient radio power harvesting might yield a milliwatt or so to a device. That's not very much. It would require 20 milliwatts to keep a mobile phone in standby mode, but it might be enough to perform some useful low-power functions.
Doesn't sound like much, but, you know, that's actually a lot for sensors.
You know, you may not be able to make a cell phone call, but maybe you can press, you know, a 911 button that does nothing but sends this, you know, one very small but very important data packet. I think many consumer electronic devices will start to have a little kind of reptilian brain that, you know, perhaps never powers down, and perhaps that is being powered off of ambient RF signals. You know, there's the annoying flashing VCR clock. I don't know if people have VCRs anymore, but so that may be another solution to the problem. But no reason why digital clocks in the future should ever run out of energy. I think if you wait a few years, it'll actually get really practical, and I don't see why you wouldn't see it all over the place.
It's amazing to think that there's so much energy just ambiently surrounding us, and the potential for us to actually harvest it, make use of it. This is arguably not the most useful thing ever, but I think the potential is really there to make some very user-friendly applications.
Nikola Tesla's tower was torn down in 1916. Mr. Morgan, his financier, was uninterested in broadcasting electricity that people could so easily harvest for free. Instead, we strung wires and built meters. Tesla knew that wireless power transfer was possible, but he never saw his dream realized. It seems that soon enough, we will.
There you go. So, one of the things that I wanted to point out was that when they're talking about charging up wirelessly cell phones, and he was running a digital thermometer using radio waves coming from a tower that was down the way. Now, you wouldn't think that that's that big of a deal, but when you plug that transformer into your wall outlet, even a 5-volt transformer, the USB charger, when you plug that into your outlet, it's got a primary coil inside there, and so it's constantly being having energy pushed to it, and so it's going to get warm. That heat is a form of energy loss, unless you're using it to heat your house, but nonetheless. So imagine you got let's say you got 20 devices in your house, all low-powered devices like your digital alarm clock, which doesn't require near as much power to run the digital alarm clock than your wall outlets actually pushing out at it. So you take 20 devices off of the power grid, and now only all you're running is your heavy-duty devices. All those 20 other devices that are being charged wirelessly while they're sitting idle, picking up radio waves or even wasted energy off of whatever transformer. If you got an electric motor running and you have that within that field of that electric motor, then now you could charge your phone up while you're running your fan. You know, if you take a wireless AC tester, you can actually see how far the field is coming away from the wiring itself. Just the doggone power cords, if you can hear that beeping in the background there, just the power cords that are pushing that energy out or through the wires, there's a field around there. There's a magnetic field, and if you're within that magnetic field, you can pick that power up. Now keep in mind, if you pull power off of that, then that's a little bit less power that's actually going because of the way that it actually works. You're guiding some of that power in a different direction. I've actually got, and I've showed it in my neodymium magnet accelerator videos that I've been doing. I actually got to get on Twitch and probably do another one because they only allow you 14 or 15 days and then they delete your video. And so I need to get on there and do another live stream. Maybe I'll show some folks what it is I'm talking about on that. But there's little transformers that they call like choke coils and stuff like that. And some of them are to clean up a signal in audio. And you can actually pull power off of that system that's not needed to run that system. If it only takes me so much power to get that magnet spinning around, and I find that is that exact sweet spot where I know the exact amount of voltage needed to put to it or the exact amount of current needed to put to it to run it, the rest of that is all free energy. The rest of it's wasted. And it's wasted in the form of heat. It'll cause my circuits to get hot. It'll cause my wiring to get hot. And so if I don't have that perfect balance in there, then I'm bound to have a wire fire or some catastrophic failure or something like that. And since I don't want catastrophic failure, then, I need to make sure I get that all down to where I can guide that energy to where I want to go. Not to where it, wants to go. Right now, the only path from your wall outlet to your fan is that cord. And they say because you're drawing too many amps that doggone cord will get hot. Like if you're trying to run a space heater, they say that you're drawing too many amps because that space heater is requiring too much power to run. What's wrong? It's completely wrong. It's not the fact that you are drawing too many amps because you're not drawing any more than that space heater can actually use. What you're doing is when that current's coming out of the wall, it slams into the resistance of either the tungsten or the nichrome and it meets that resistance. Those nichrome wire and tungsten are basically designed to resist current flow. So when they get hot, they will glow. Just like any other wire. If you get any wire too hot, too much current going through there, it'll glow. But the difference between tungsten and nichrome is they can handle a lot more heat. Now, in your incandescent light bulb, the only reason why your element doesn't burn out so quickly from that extreme amount of heat of the current that you're pushing to it is because that it's inside of a vacuum and it doesn't have the oxygen and everything necessary for it to actually burn in half. It's basically the fire is not being fed, so to speak. And due to the thickness of the tungsten element in there will determine on the lumens and the wattage output that you'll get out of it, how bright the bulb's actually going to be and how much current you're actually putting to it. You can put more current to a light bulb than what you're doing now, and it'll get super, super bright. But it won't last very long. It'll burn in half, and the light bulb's no good anymore. However, if you understand voltage and how this voltage actually works, it needs a path. It's just like, all electricity needs a path. It needs a path to get to, from point A to point B. Well, A current, unless you got a lot of current with a lot of voltage, you're not going to leap across the gap inside there of a tungsten element bulb that the element itself is burned in half. But with voltage, at the right frequency, you can leap across that. It'll energize the whatever atmosphere is inside that bulb, and it will ionize that air and give itself a path. It'll build its own bridge from the one side of the broken element to the other side of the broken element. And then when it finally gets to the point where it's resonating so rapidly, it will cause that same effect and it will light that light bulb up, even though that light bulb will not work on standard form of electricity anymore. So even a dead light bulb is still salvageable. You can ramp the frequency up of the energy that you're pushing into that light bulb, and even a light bulb that otherwise did not work. I did this in a video quite some time back called Vacuum Spark Gap, where I used an old headlamp off of a vehicle that had burned up. It won't, you plug it onto a battery and it won't light up anymore. But I use it as a spark gap. And since I was running a 20,000 volt oil burner igniter and that frequency was high enough, it was able to leap across the gap and light that light bulb up anyway. And so, because I got an understanding of how mechanically the energy is actually traveling, I understand what needs to be done in order to be able to make really incredibly efficient machinery and electronics and electrical devices, and that the energy that we're pushing to them, we can take what would have otherwise been a loss that would have generated heat via eddy currents or resistance, and we can turn that loss into a plus and run more devices off of less energy. Right now, the amount of energy that you're using in your house is ridiculous. You don't need that much power. If you built a storage bank before you ever even used any of that power, you had a massive storage bank, and you draw that power off only what you needed to run whichever given device, your electricity bill would drop clean to the dirt, because all you got to do is trickle charge that storage bank, and you got more than enough power to do it on demand, so you'd be able to push energy to that thing and keep those capacitor banks filled up at all times. And then if you want to run inverter systems where you're going to be using induction to produce a different type of sine wave or whatever electrical signal, then you got to understand once you start using that energy, that inverter is actually going to start to generate some losses itself because of heat, because of the way that it's actually designed. But you could re-engineer that inverter to use that energy efficiently without having all them waste. And you can guide whatever leftover energy would have otherwise been wasted, you can guide it off into something else, a different storage bank, for example. You can store heat, you can store air pressure, you can store electricity. It's all one and the same, folks. It's just that we're moving these particles and molecules around, at its different speeds and producing these electromagnetic waves and such. That's the way that science explains it. But nonetheless, Once you get a grasp on how this energy is actually traveling, then that's whenever the light bulb should come on in your head and you'd understand that we've had free energy all along. We've never been without free energy. It's the devices that we're running, it's how we're using the power that is the problem. Now, right now, every household out there is running incredibly inefficient. Beyond ridiculously inefficient. I'd even go as far as to say ludicrous of how inefficient that everything is. These devices that we've got right now, these computers, the transistors and resistors and all that stuff inside there, and the circuit boards, microchips, there, you think you have to have current to shove to that thing and be able to get more faster processing out of the deal. Which you don't. And when you realize how they actually function, right now you could heat your room with your computer. Because it's generating a lot of heat. That's why it's got to have a fan. But once you understand how that energy is traveling and what's actually causing that heat, and that heat is a bad thing, it's gonna cause your computer to eventually fail, and you start guiding that energy off and storing it somewhere, or allowing that energy a place to go as opposed to, just bouncing back and forth between the power outlet and the device you're trying to run, And it's happening all the way through the entire system, from one part of the system to the next. When the current does get past this system, now it's going to the next one, and it's doing the same thing. The energy's bouncing back and forth inside there, and it's building up, and it's producing resistance. It's meeting resistance. It's producing heat. And so eventually something's got to give, and it's usually the lower, it's always the lower thermal breakdown part that's going to fail first. We can re-engineer specifically all of our different internal combustion engines to not only run cleaner, to run cooler, and focus the energy to where we need it. The only place in an internal combustion engine that you need heat is in the cylinder. You don't need it anywhere else. And the only reason why you would need heat to have anything to do with the oil is that you got to keep, like if you're in a cold climate and you don't want the oil getting really thick because then it won't be able to circulate, you want to put a little bit of heat to the oil. So some places they have actual oil heaters, and other places they have oil coolers, depending on your climate. Because you got to have that oil to be able to be warm enough to where its viscosity is just right to where it can still be pumped through a pumping system and circulated around your parts. But if properly engineered, you'd barely need any lubrication because you're never going to reach the thermal breakdown of the part that it is that you're trying to protect. And so if it can't reach its thermal breakdown, it cannot fail, period. So, with different types of synthetic oils and greases and stuff like that, that super lubrication, that we could actually design systems to where, you know, you basically put just a tiny bit of lubrication down inside there, and if the temperature ever gets to a certain degrees higher than it's supposed to, it will actually drop another drop or two down inside there to compensate for it to give that heat energy, you know, a place to go to basically stop the friction. And that's, you know, when you're talking about mechanical, the friction is basically what causes the heat, and it, you know, things rubbing up against each other. So I hope that by now you have a mechanical understanding of what electricity is actually doing. What electricity is basically still an unknown in science. Nobody really knows what electricity is. That what we call electricity, nobody really knows what it is. This theory about how you can induce current and all that, which we can see, we can actually do. But what's actually going on down there as far as whether there is or isn't an electron, whether the electron theory is right or wrong, doesn't matter. We know that this one cause gets this one effect, and so we can actually generate electricity. We know that if we speed that same exact process up, you can take any generator you got out there, and you run it at its normal RPM, you'll get 120 volts AC. You know, depending on what you got going on, might be 220. Nonetheless, depending on how the system's set up. You take that same exact generator and you hook it to a high-speed transmission and you start off in low gear, you'll get that thing going and it'll be producing its normal voltage. When you start to build up the speed on that and you start raising them RPMs up, you will ramp the voltage up higher and higher and higher and higher. You know, I did a video where I took a hard drive motor, computer hard drive motor, and spun it up about 25,000-30,000 RPMs or higher with using a Dremel and a buffing wheel, and I was able to light up a whole entire strand of LED lighting that was set up to run off of 120 volts AC. Now, some folks didn't think that that was all that big of a deal. But if you took that doggone hard drive motor apart and you actually looked at how tiny amount of copper wire is actually in there and how insignificantly strong or mostly weak the magnet was inside of it and how that magnet was actually designed, I was able to generate enough power to light that entire strand up just by spinning that doggone thing at that high RPM. Now, of course, you had those naysayers out there would say, well, you know, it took you this much power to use that Dremel. You know, yeah, it's plugged into 120 volts AC. That wasn't the point. That wasn't what I was trying to show you. I had to pay attention to what I was trying to show you is that if you raise that RPM up, it doesn't matter how much copper windings you got in there. That doggone thing is going to ramp the voltage up. So whatever's going on inside there, it's acting like a pump. It's acting like the pump of electricity. It's pressurizing electricity, and it's ramping that voltage way up. And so that was enough to actually light that strand of light bulbs. So any generator out there that you got, and matter of fact, proof positive is if you go to any of the automobiles out there, most automobiles, all automobiles do have a voltage regulator. Some voltage regulators are actually built into the alternator itself. And if you got a generator style, it might have an external voltage regulator. Because you never know when you smash on the gas and that engine RPM starts to raise up. Well, you're also raising the voltage up in the circuitry of your car. Well, your car is only meant to run off of 12 volts, or depending on what you got, you might have a 24 volt system or even down to a 6 volt system. But it can only handle so much voltage and only handle so much current. Well, whenever you smash the gas and start flying down the road, that alternator is going along with you. It's spinning just as fast as your motor is now. And so you got to be able to either shut that dang off, or you know, guide that power somewhere else. Otherwise, you'll start a wire fire in your vehicle. So you got a voltage regulator. So there's tons and tons of wasted energy in your alternator. And if you understand what your alternator is actually doing, and you understand how to store power and how your battery actually works, then you will understand why it is that in high-end car audio stereos that they use these 500,000 and above microfarad capacitors to basically supplement the battery so that the stereo is running off of the capacitor instead of directly off the battery, which allows the battery time to charge. And the alternator is capable of pushing the power necessary to keep the capacitor charged, as well as the battery itself is able to still continue to push the current forward to keep the pressure going so that your amplifier runs and everything else will run as well. Heck, I got two of them. These are 10 farad. That's, you know, a heck of a lot more. For 500,000 microfarad, you're looking at probably 2 farad worth of power. They make 10 farad capacitors, probably even make them higher than that. But that's a lot of stored energy. It means you can store a lot of power in there. And so with that said, knowing that a battery isn't designed to charge and discharge rapidly, it takes a little while and a little bit of current in order, because that battery will start pushing back. If you don't have enough current to shove to that battery, it'll start pushing back. And that's what's going on. You're trying to force it in through resistance. But with voltage, you don't have that resistance. You can still charge a battery with voltage. Alright? So, when it comes to capacitors can charge and discharge rapidly without getting hot like a battery. And you can destroy a battery, you know, pushing too much current to it or not charging it enough, you know, allowing it to get down lower than its operating range as far as voltage goes. In that particular instance, you could actually revive that type of battery situation. It's just whenever the battery, you know, builds up crud inside it and shorts out the plates, then you have to flush that battery out really good using something like baking soda to dissolve the minerals and stuff that's wedged in between the plates, and you can restore that battery. So, now I hope that by this time in the show, you've already got a better understanding of how energy actually travels. Now it's just a matter about, what are you going to do with that information? You know, an idea is just an idea until you act upon it. That's how come, you know, I got a neodymium magnet accelerator and all these different projects, is because as soon as I get an idea, I take whatever resources I have available and I build a prototype so that I can test it and retest it and repeat and so on down the line. And then I can come back and I can give you the findings of everything that I've been discovering through all this time. Through all my years of mad science, I've used everything from recycled materials to things that people just throwed out in the trash, that repurposed items. And now, you know, things are a little bit different. I'm wanting to expand and I'm wanting to build on, you know, more prototypes to, in order to show it's not theory what I'm talking about. It's reality. This is actual provable science. Everything that I've been saying all this time is all provable science. Some folks are aggravated because they don't use the proper terminology and whatever, and I'm trying to explain to the average Joe, and they don't think I'm telling them right or whatever, and they think I might be misleading somebody and teaching them the wrong thing, which, you know, it doesn't matter what those individuals say. If you test what it is that I'm talking about, if you actually try it, you might find out that science hasn't told the whole story. That what you learn in school might not be the way that things are actually functioning. These pressure waves that we're doing, you can design systems that are so tiny that, knowing how this energy works right now and knowing the different causes and effects, like a magnet vibrating through a coil of wire or whatever, you could build teeny tiny little circuits that would actually, so much as a vibration, so much as a sneeze, would generate just a tiny bit of current, tiny bit of voltage in the milliamp range. You know, and that little tiny device right there could actually store energy, and then when the energy got stored enough where the container was completely full, your capacitor was completely full, that voltage could then in turn break over through another circuit and hit a stronger pulse on another device to ramp that voltage up to take in charge another system even quicker. So you're only limited by your imagination. That's the deal. If it can be scaled up, it can be scaled down, vice versa. Now, if you're into researching, don't let any of these people out there that who believe that they know it all discourage you from trying anything. Because the science isn't settled. And it won't be settled until we're flying around in George Jetson-style cars and being beamed up to a spaceship above the atmosphere or something like that. When we get to that high tech, then, you know, maybe you might want to see if you can, you know, go any further, or maybe back to school or something like that. But in the meantime, science ain't settled. Science doesn't even really know whether or not the electron really exists. There's folks out there to argue till you're blue in the face. Go out there and look up, see if you can find a picture of the electron. And then whenever you get that picture of electron, break it down on how they actually got that picture. You're not actually even looking at what it really would look like if that's what was going on. But if you take and you make a scale model of what the standard model of what the electron, the proton, and the neutron that makes up the atom and all that, if you make up a scaled up model so that you can get a visual and explain to somebody in graphic detail, look, this is what science says is going on, but something's different here, because as that electron is spinning around that accelerator right there, I'm noticing that it produces a vacuum on one side and it produces a pressure on the other side. So it's actually pulling energy into that vacuum, and then it's pushing energy around, and when those energies start to collide with one another, it's like if you're driving down the road in a really fast car, and you got somebody who has an even faster car comes flying up behind you, and now you're getting a push down the road, and so on down the line. You hit the next slowest one and you speed them up. Next thing you go, everybody's pushing everybody down the road. So what's occurring inside there is acceleration that isn't explained in the electron theory. And that changing field of that magnet spinning around in there, instead of it dissipating that energy in the form of friction and heat, those coils stay perfectly cold. But it's still producing another frequency from the north and the south field of that magnet spinning around that is able to build up its own pressure and start pushing back on the system. The same system that's trying to take that energy from the motor controller. And now the motor controller is pushing out more power than that thing needs. And eventually you end up with the wire fire. And if you take in consideration what I've been talking about today, you know that you can allow that excess energy to go off into a different place, a different storage bank. And so you still have the same amount of power going to it, but any excess power can be guided away from it. It is no different than you running water through a water-cooled heat sink. You're taking that heat energy away from the system. You're taking the pressure off of the wire and allowing that wire to allow that energy a path to go somewhere else. Folks, we're using too much energy. We're using too much power coming out of our wall outlets to run our appliances. Those electric heaters, they're not drawing anything. There's no draw of amperage. That energy that's coming out of that wall is meeting resistance, and if the weakest part of the materials will reach its thermal breakdown, if you don't have a breaker switch, it'll start a fire. That's how much power is coming out of there. And so you guide that power away from that system. In the meantime, the status quo, the standard that's going on right now, energy out the wall outlet, slams into the doggone electric motor, bounces back the other direction. It's exactly like you see in that wave whenever you take that slinky and you push it back and forth, or you wobble it side to side or up and down. That energy goes from one side, bounces back. As soon as it meets resistance, it bounces back, and it'll do it as many times as it takes to disperse that energy. Now, if you had a path for that energy to go instead of just slamming into the wall, the moment it slams into the wall, a gate opens and you send that energy off into a different direction, that slinky would not do what it does. That energy would have a place to go instead. But instead, it translates back through the slinky. And so now the slinky is actually getting warm. Believe it or not, whenever you're playing with a slinky, it'll warm itself up because you're moving all those particles around and back and forth, and you're oscillating it, and you're generating friction between the little particles that make up the slinky. The same thing applies with electricity. Same thing applies with water, air, you name it. It doesn't matter. All energy it all works the same. It travels on waves. And the moment the world gets that in their head, then they'll understand how that we can be so incredibly energy efficient. Just by taking the time to do a little bit of math, a little bit of re-engineering, and you don't even have to reinvent the wheel. There's means by which we can adapt things to the vehicles that we've got right now to take that heat energy, which would have otherwise been a loss. Take a digital thermometer, or any type of thermometer for that matter. Go out there and drive your vehicle around the block a few times, and then measure the temperature of it. That's a lot of energy. And if you guided that energy where you wanted it to go to get something done, well, you do it sort of, because when you turn your heater on in the wintertime, it's taking the heat off of that engine and it's keeping you warm inside the cab. Ain't no difference in what I've been trying to explain. What I'm saying is take it a step further. You can turn that thermal heat into electricity. You can turn that heat into pressure. You can store the heat. There's materials out there. If you go look at like the old style thermoses and see how they're designed and how they're insulated. If you put something in it cold, it will remain cold. If you put something in it hot, it will remain hot. And it will remain that way until somehow or another it has a path for that energy to go elsewhere. It's that simple. So, as far as free energy, the science is settled. If you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough for it. Period. No ifs, ands, or buts. Now, when you talk about terminology such as over-unity or zero-point or perpetual motion, those are, in my opinion, those are put out there to discourage anybody from really getting down to the truth of free energy. That's why so many people fail. Because they're always trying to figure out how to get something for nothing. When they already had something for nothing. All you had to do is cause and effect. That's it. Cause and effect. And do it in the most efficient manner. It don't take much power to push that swing the first time. But once you get that motion started, it takes less and less power once you get past that initial point. And the same thing would apply with the way that you generate electricity. The moment it hits any kind of resistance whatsoever, that generator will bog down. But if you store that power before you ever use it, that generator will never bog down. So, with that said, I just told you how to become so incredibly energy efficient in your alternator, on your car, in your generators, on your tractors, in your generators for your campers, all the way to the electricity coming out of your wall outlet. The moment you paid your electric bill, anything that comes into your house is yours. You paid for it. And so if you have an energy storage system, just like the, what do they call them, UPSs or APCs, the energy storage that you use for emergency power in case your lights go out, your computer won't crash on you. Those only last for 15 minutes. They're only designed for give you enough time to shut your computer down so it don't crash. But modern day processes are pretty doggone amazing. They're almost crash proof anymore. But nonetheless, you can go out to flea markets and you can buy those old battery backups. They only got maybe one or two batteries in them. Depending on the size that you got, might have a couple more batteries in them. those batteries could either, the system could either be a 12 volt or 24 volt or even 36 volt or higher system. So you have to look inside there and you see the battery of what it says, whether it's a 12 volt or whatever, and see how they're ran. So if you got three batteries run in series and you got a 36 volt system, you can run three more batteries in parallel that are also in series. These three batteries are in series. You can run them in parallel with the three batteries that's already in there. And now you just went from 15 minutes to 30 minutes. And then you put another set of batteries in there, and now you just went even longer. The larger your storage bank, the more time that you'll have. And with the old APCs, the moment the doggone power goes off, it's got this annoying little bleeper noise in there that lets you know you're on backup power. Clip that wire, and you don't have to listen to the noise. But you just built yourself an inverter system with a battery backup and a battery bank that whenever your power goes off, it will detect and it will turn the battery bank on and run the inverters to run your appliance. And so, if for some reason you had a large enough battery bank and you only had to run your electricity to that battery bank for part of the day, and then the rest of the day you run your electricity in your house off of the battery bank, then you're only paying for half the amount of power. You don't have to sit there and run power straight off the pole. All you got to do is fill up your storage up there. Once you got your storage full, you already paid for that electricity. It's that simple. So, just think about that. And then, from that point on, how efficient are you going to use that energy? Instead of drawing directly off of those batteries, you take a little bit of knowledge from what they were doing in the car audio amplifiers and using those capacitors, and you're actually drawing off of those capacitors because they're designed to be able to charge and discharge rapidly, whereas those batteries are not. With those capacitors in between there, you got a large enough bank, now your battery doesn't even have to work hard. And so you got your power outlet trickle charging your battery bank during the daytime, and at night you flip the switch on the breaker over there and you're not using the power off the pole anymore. You're using stored power, stored energy, and you're using it in an incredibly efficient manner. One doggone 2,500 watt generator has more power in it than you can possibly imagine. If used properly, you can use that energy, you can use that generator to store up power. Imagine this. Let's say you drink a gallon of water a day. Alright? And it might take you a little while to fill that gallon of water up, depending on where you're getting it at. Well, if a week prior to that, I went out and I stored up 10 gallons. I only need one of those gallons a day. So that means 10 days, all I got to do is take 10 days and I can fill up that other gallon. So it only takes me 10 days to fill up that other gallon. I hope you understand what I just explained to you. You start charging it before you ever even use it. You got money in the bank. You got energy in the bank. And then if you can get through the whole doggone night and it only took you part of the day in order to fill that bank, the longer you can run off of that storage bank, the less amount of power you'll have to pull off of that doggone electrical outlet. And the power company is going to start saying, well, how is it your light bill is going down? Are you stealing electricity? No, sir. No, ma'am. I paid for every bit of electricity that you sent into my house. Just a matter of fact that I understood how energy travels, and I ramped it up, amplified it, charged a massive storage bank, and then I only needed you for a brief moment just to give me that first push down the hill, and then I rode the rest of it along with nature. So, if you can't find free energy, folks, you hadn't been listening to mad science, obviously. Because mad science is only mad science because mainstream science won't tell you what I just did. The electric companies out there, they're not going to come out there and say, yeah, look, let's really seriously get you energy efficient because we don't want as much money as you're sending us. That's ridiculous. They're going to say, hey, yeah, go buy this energy efficient appliance, knowing fully well that that energy efficient appliance might be slightly more efficient than others, but not to the extent where it's actually going to make any significant difference. You put an energy saver bulb throughout all your houses. The old fluorescent ones still had a doggone transformer in it. The old fluorescent long ones, they got a ballast in them, which is still a transformer. Doesn't matter. You're still pushing power. You got one of those transformers per set of lights. Well, that's 120 or 220 volts, whichever version you're on, times how many ever is in your house, with the same thing as the little bitty little fluorescent bulbs that they call them CFLs. Each one of those got a tiny little transformer in them. And go feel them after they've been on for a while. They're hot because they're getting too much power. It ain't because of the process. It's because of how the energy is bouncing back and forth between the wall outlet or the socket and the doggone transformer that's inside there, and the resistance that it's meeting. And if you understand that, then you can design better lighting systems to where you're not getting that wasted energy. So we have the capability. We have the full capability to reach incredible efficiency. I mean off the scale efficiency, to the extent where if you had to pay a dollar a month for your light bill, I would be amazed. And so I always told everybody, when I go off the power grid, I'm going to do it in style. You're going to know it. I'm still on the power grid. Because when I go off the power grid, I'm taking the world with me. We're all going off the power grid. Because I'm going to give you the doggone information ahead of time so that whenever it happens and you see that and then you all watch all the men in black come rushing over there to maul me, you know, take me off to containment facility, so to speak, you're already going to know why it is that they showed up at my doorstep. And you're already going to have the same amount of information. And what you do with that information from that point on, that's up to you. So, I'm not rushing myself to get men in black kicking down my door just yet. I got a few things to accomplish. Such as I got to make sure enough people understand what it is I'm trying to show them. So that the information don't get suppressed and it doesn't get buried. Doesn't get bought out, doesn't get patented or any of that stuff, or companies will be able to say that they can't, you can't use it because it's theirs. No, it belongs to the people. The world was given to the people, the energy was given to the people, and we were given dominion over it. And so with that said, everybody owns it. Everybody owns the water. Everybody owns the air. Everybody owns the wind and the sun and the electricity. And there's more electricity on this earth than you can possibly imagine. There's more energy available than you could use in a trillion, 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 quadrillion, super bazillion lifetimes. You ain't never going to run out of it. And you ain't going to run out of water. And the world is not overpopulated. You're not going to starve to death unless you choose to starve to death. And the people out there who are starving to death in this world is because mankind chose to allow it to be so. There's more than enough resources available. There's more than enough energy available. You're not going to run out of crude oil. You're not going to run out of oxygen. You're not going to run out of anything in this self-contained biosphere of epic proportions. The thermoelectric generator, static electric generator, it has everything to provide for us. The only thing that we can't provide for each other because we can't seem to figure it out is that we got to work together to make this place, instead of a mess, to be quite literally a heaven on our earth, a utopia, so to speak. When we start working together, there ain't nothing we can't accomplish. We've got access to a vast sum of all man's knowledge at our fingertips and then some. And so the day that we decide to become the dream team that you always hear me speak about, then we're going to witness what we witness. We're going to see the wars and the rumors of wars and the plagues and the famine and the pestilence and the starvation and the sickness. We're going to continue to see it until we realize that that person sitting across from you is just as important piece of the puzzle as you are. And if we can actually see eye to eye and come together past all the distractions, then there is no stopping us from that point on. It's like when you get that train up to speed, it takes miles and miles and miles and a lot of energy to stop a train. You get that big giant ship up to speed, it takes miles and miles and miles and tons of energy to stop that ship. The forward momentum of a jet airliner. And I could go on and on and on. Tractor trailer flying down the road at 70, 80 miles an hour. It suddenly has to come to a stop. It takes a lot of energy to stop that tractor trailer. And once you understand what it is that I just showed you, what I just told you, what I put in your mind, that picture, that mechanical understanding of energy itself, when you get us started, when you get our momentum up to speed, there is nothing. There's not enough power to stop us. It's that simple. I call it mad science because I'm watching as this world does what it does, and the solutions are there. The simplicity of how this entire thing functions, and how people try to overcomplicate the simple, how they try to suppress knowledge so that you got to go to them to fix this, or you got to go to them to fix that, including yourself. You got to go to the doctor because only the doctor knows what the doctor does. You got to go to the mechanic. I'm saying, what's stopping us from taking our fields of expertise and focusing all of our energy in for the betterment of all of each of us and all of humanity? Or simply just doing the right thing? Energy is free. And I challenge anyone in this world to come face me down. Debate me. Why is it not free? Don't bring your so-called laws of physics. Bring the information that tells me why it is that two times out of that 10 that you basically wrote that physics law, why it is that two times out of 10 you got a different result. Explain that. Don't tell me what you think gravity is. Don't tell me what you think that energy is. show me. We got science's best guess is what they say. That's our best guess. That's our theory. Well, if you sit down long enough and you step back and you look at the big picture and you sit there and observe everything out there, that's what science is all about. Doesn't matter if you're just studying nature or whatever you're studying. Observing, testing, repeating, so on down the line. You have science. And when the book doesn't match what your eyes are telling you, when the book doesn't match what the math said, when the book doesn't match what the physical reactions of all these different things are, when somebody says you can't and they can't tell you why, or when they say it's not possible and they can't tell you why, I'm sitting here saying it is possible, and here's why. That's mad science in a nutshell. We got what it takes to fix this world. We got what it takes to fix it all. Every last part. There isn't a problem on this earth that we can't resolve, with the exception of the human condition that for some reason or another likes to keep us apart. I don't know why it is. I don't know why it is at all. Now, I can see somebody wanting to go to war to steal somebody else's resources so that they can't become wealthy and powerful. I can see why it is the electric company wouldn't say certain things to you because they don't want to lose out on the gravy train. I can see why it is that J.P. Morgan would want to tear down the Wardenclyffe Tower because he can't make no money off of it. I get all that. For greed and stupidity, selfishness, we live in the world that we live in today. But if it were not for all of that, the world that we would live in would be so incredibly amazing, so clean and healthy, that I think if our Creator were to look down on us, they'd smile. We have the power. We've always had the power. We were created in our Creator's image. And we were given dominion over this earth and one another. We are our brother's keepers. We're supposed to be taking care of each other. We're supposed to be taking care of the earth. We're supposed to be taking care of the planet, the animals, the wildlife, the plants and animals, everything. That's what we're supposed to be doing. We're actually here to work and to learn. And when you see the world the way it is out there, and you spent a lifetime studying science, it's a heart-wrenching thing to see people suffer needlessly. To see people die from things that they could have been cured for. It's really frustrating. I know there's answers out there because I've seen them. And I know there's technology on the way because I've seen it. I've seen where this world could go, and I've seen where it is going. And we're not destined to doom unless we choose it. We're not destined for all the doom and gloom unless we choose it. That's the crazy thing about this whole game that we're in. We have a choice. Each and every one of you is like a gear in a machine. You take one of those gears out of that machine, and it doesn't function properly. It may still work, but there's one part of it that's not going to work right. put that gear back in that machine, and it works flawlessly the way that it was designed. Energy is free. And there's nobody out there who is educated enough, intelligent enough, or well versed in high tech terminology enough to convince me otherwise. Because I've studied since the day I've got here on how every single thing works. I paid attention in school. I'm wanting to share that knowledge with everybody and his brother, everybody and his sister. I want to share that knowledge with the world, and I do it in the best way that I can with what I've got to work with. So that's why it is I do what I do, because I really do care. The Mad Science Show might sometimes sound like a loud, obnoxious know-it-all, but the mad science inside my heart is what matters. I just find myself getting frustrated because I don't have the right words at the right time to explain to the world that you're looking right directly into the eyes of your own miracle when you're looking at yourself. And it we can fix all of this. But we're racing the clock. Quite literally, our worst enemy is ourselves. And we're racing the clock. Things ain't got so bad right now that we can't fix it all. But it's just like any other problem. If you let it grow, it will get so far out of hand that we won't be able to fix it. Folks, I'm just going to spend the rest of the Mad Science Show just playing a couple tunes and taking the breather for my lungs and my brain. But before I go up out of here, I hope you enjoyed today's show and I hope you share it with somebody. And I'm going to continue to do what I can do. And I'm going to keep on trying to share things with people. I might be a little crazy in the head, and I got to share things in a creative fashion, because it seems like it's the only way to get anybody's attention long enough. But there is a method to my madness. And I believe where there is a will, there is definitely, without a doubt, a way. Peace and love, everybody. You've been listening to Mad Science.
says it's the end of time. And the Mississippi River, she's a gold dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see, a woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Those whistling old boys raise. Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. And we can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, 'cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. We can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
television studio.
Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends. There it is.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.